Welcome to the Contagious Courage Podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Matheson, and on this podcast, you'll be hearing people's stories. Stories of people who are doing good in their communities, people who are making a difference. As Howard Zinn once said, "To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction." I'm getting back into the swing of things now that I'm on summer vacation, and I'm excited to pick back up season two with a dear friend, Catherine Noyed. Thank you so much for joining me today, Katie.
Stephanie, it's so good to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and this is actually my very first international overseas recording. Katie is joining us from Denmark.
Yeah, that's right.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that later and what you're doing over there. But what I want to talk about today really is eating disorders. We're in month three of social distancing, and things are starting to open back up. But one thing I've started to hear a lot, or a decent amount, is this COVID-15. Not to be confused with COVID-19, in reference to, you know, the freshman 15. Gyms were closed. People were spending all day at home. So they're using the phrase COVID-15. And while I think many people are saying it in good fun, it can be a bit triggering for others. And there are many people who have been, I think, struggling even more during this time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you have a personal story with an eating disorder. And I know that there's still a lot of stigma around it, but you've started to use your blog to share information and bring light to it. And I was wondering if you would be willing to share just a little bit of your story, or what you feel comfortable with.
Yeah. Should I go ahead and touch on the COVID-19 first? I think I have a few points I'd like to say about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm pretty passionate about. So when people say COVID-15, even though it's intended as a fun and friendly joke, to me, I don't really see it as a joke. It actually is kind of the message that you believe that higher weight bodies are not as ideal. They're less deserving, and that having one should be avoided, well, like the plague. And quite frankly, this is, it's fat shaming, it's insensitive, and quite damaging as well. And I can think of three different groups it's hurtful towards. The first is people in higher weight bodies. We all have different size frames, and not one is better than the other. And if you say that in passing to someone who might be in a higher weight body, then that can be very hurtful because the message you're saying is clear. A second group that could be damaging for is people who have a history of an eating disorder or who are currently struggling. And the third group is people with impressionable or developing minds. I'm thinking of children, I'm thinking of teenagers, but I'm also thinking of people who might be susceptible to the development of an eating disorder. But in all honesty, the COVID-15 joke can be hurtful towards everyone. And these comments, though they're made with innocent intent, they shape the world that we live in. And it's a world that's already run down by diet culture. And we see it in the movies, in magazines, in billboards, and on Instagram. And it almost trickles down to the comments that we make. Mm-hmm. And we might not realize that we're making these, but I recommend that we all check in with ourselves and ask, why am I saying this? Do I believe that thin bodies are better? Do I believe that larger bodies should be shamed? And if the question or if the answer is yes, then you should ask why. In my bet, it's the multi-billion-dollar diet industry and their passive and active messaging that has influenced the reality. But to be honest, it's not your fault. And everywhere we look, there's diet culture, and it's normalized in our society. Mm-hmm. But the best thing that we can do is reject it and stop putting it forward with its messages. So, yeah,
that's really good. I think, you know, just in the last couple of years, I've started to pay a lot more attention to the wording that I use, mm-hmm. beyond, you know, things like COVID-15 around body image. Just there are so many things that we say on a daily basis that can be hurtful and damaging. And I think when we start to think about why we say those things and how they can impact others, and, you know, what other way could I say what I'm trying to say?
Right.
You know, I've started to do a lot of self-reflection around that. So
yeah, and now is a great time to do it too, because we're at home, we have more time on our hands, and there's just so many resources online to the best way to communicate what you are feeling, or maybe it is diet culture that is the reason why you're saying certain things too. So yeah, reflection is always so important, and I'm personally always growing too. I'm always trying to learn the best way to phrase things as well. So definitely. Yeah.
So you bring up diet cultures, and I do want you to share your story, but could you share what's the difference between a diet and an eating disorder, and can there be a slippery slope there?
Yeah, absolutely. So eating disorders are mental disorders, and they're actually in the diagnostic statistical manual of mental disorders, and we're now in the 5th edition. And diet behaviors, they may look similar to eating disorder behaviors, but they just might not fit the criteria for a full-blown diagnosis yet. With diets, they can be a slippery slope, like what you were saying, and they're often a gateway into eating disorders. And in fact, 35% of pathological dieters will develop disordered eating, and 25% will develop a full-blown eating disorder. And what's really scary is that actually eating disorders are the number 2 most deadly psychological disorder behind opioid addiction. And so you're really playing with fire when you have a diet. But oftentimes that's how they do start, and that's actually how mine started as well.
Yeah. How, you know, I know that you've been a dancer for mm-hmm. for many years. Mm-hmm. How did your start, and what was your journey through that?
Yeah, you know, I always had a pretty normal and wonderful upbringing. I'm very thankful for that. I had access to nutritious foods, and movement was always a fun part of my life growing up. We went on bike rides, and we played soccer in the backyard, and we always had a lot of fun around being healthy and lively. And it wasn't until I was around 16 years old where I decided that I wanted to do a big life change. And I did some research. I was looking through articles, and it was all pop culture articles saying that certain types of food were bad and they should be avoided. And so that's when I first had my introduction to food having moral value. Mm-hmm. And I was able to keep this up for a while too. So I was able to see that good foods were the only ones that I wanted. And it was kind of like a hobby or an addiction for me. And I got organized. Mm-hmm. I started counting calories, and it was a way for me to stay on track and to remain good and do things just so perfectly. And I got very organized too. And there were special times that I could eat. There are certain times I could drink water, and I had all of my days mapped out. And you mentioned the dancing background too. That was a part of it as well. At that time, I was competing with both my studio and high school dance teams, and I was training around 6 times a week for multiple hours a day. And that just wasn't enough. Something in my mind kept saying that I should be doing more, that what I wasn't doing, I should be spending more time doing activities. So I started working out more on top of that, and with running and strength. And a little bit of a trigger warning too, is that results started taking place. Mm-hmm. The scale told me this. I checked it multiple times a day, the first second, then I woke up, when I got home from school, when I went to bed. And there's a lot of positive reinforcement too. people were noticing me. They would say certain things that would act as words of affirmation that I was doing things the right way, that I looked the right way. Mm-hmm. And being a dancer and seeing mirrors everywhere and at the competitive studio that we are at, we would either wear leotards and tights or like a sports bra and booty shorts too. So your body was always on display, and that definitely did not help. Mm-hmm. But with eating disorders and with restricting to that degree, I couldn't keep that level of restriction up. I was exhausted. I was nervous. I was depressed. And I could not stop thinking about food. It was really the only thing that was on my mind. Mm-hmm. And so pretty soon that started shifting into binge eating the food that I had once deemed as bad. And so that kind of shifted into the moral part of it too, where I was eating bad foods and therefore I was a bad person. I was a loser and I felt like I couldn't control anything in my life. So that kind of spiraled out a little bit. At that time, I was looking for new diets to get back on track. I looked at like what the Victoria's Secret models did. And on Pinterest, there are these awful boards for like thinspiration. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do anything to go back to the way that people were talking to me and that reinforcement. At that time, I then graduated from high school. I moved to Denmark as an exchange student, and I thought that that would just be the best diet ever. I'd be in Europe. It'd be a new lifestyle, a new fresh start. I even started doing CrossFit and made a little PowerPoint, basically, of this is what I want my ideal body to look like, and this is how I'm going to get it. And I had so many starts, and then ultimately I would fail because I was setting myself up for failure with the all or nothing thinking. And it wasn't until spring term of my freshman year that it got so out of control at college that I ended up getting help. But unfortunately, there weren't a lot of resources in Central Oregon at that time. So I went back home to Minnesota and I got treatment. And I'm not sure if you know too much about treatment, but it's actually a very fascinating process to look back on.
Yeah, I would love to hear more about that because I actually know nothing about what treatment for an eating disorder looks like.
Totally, totally. Well, not many people do, and I had no idea going into it. But basically, I had something called symptom interruption, and it was a 2-week hospitalization. And basically, you give up all of your freedoms. You have no right to a razor, to use the restroom by yourself. You were to eat whatever they told you to eat. They checked your vitals. They weighed you. And at the time, I was super, super sick, not only with my eating disorder, but I actually had like the medical equivalent of mono. However, it had a different name and they kept testing me, but it kept turning out as not mono. But basically, when my family came to visit me at one point, they saw me and they're like, Katie, do you get a spray tan? You're yellow. But at that point, my liver was actually not doing so well. So I had jaundice. And honestly, it was the most miserable experience of my life. However, after 2 weeks, they had actually let me go home so I could be well enough to go to treatment again. Mm-hmm. I begged to be outpatient. And basically what had happened was I went there from 8 to 5 every day, or Monday through Friday. So it was like a full-time job. Yeah. And it was like taking classes. And so I had a medical doctor, a nutritionist, a psychiatrist, a psychologist. We did group therapy. There was CBT, DBT. We had music therapy. We learned a lot about Brené Brown too. But it was fascinating and it was so, so helpful. And something I think that people on the outside think is quite interesting is that we also went on field trips. So we went to grocery stores. We went to McDonald's and to other restaurants. And we would always test out certain challenging foods. We would have them, we would experience them, and then we would go back into group and talk about it too. And honestly, that was so helpful. And to hear the other people's point of views. And there was one gentleman who was in group with me, and I just remember this. He said, "Food is medicine, and I have to eat it every day at the right times to get better." Mm-hmm. And that is just so, so true. And, you know, two things about treatment. You know, without the illness I had at the time, I don't know if I would have started to go back to over-exercising, but quite literally my spleen would have exploded, they said, if I went back to running. And so that was such a blessing. And the second thing is that I really had to give up control, and my body took over from there. And I'm now 6 years in recovery, and it's just been the most wonderful thing. But with humans, we're one of the only species that think that we can outsmart our bodies. And Stephanie, if I were to tell you that right now you need to put down the phone and go to the restroom, that wouldn't work out, would it? But we think we can be smarter than our bodies. We think that we can tell our bodies what they need and what they, what timing everything works out. But our bodies are just so, so smart, and they can do it on their own. And through treatment, I learned how to eat intuitively and just listen to what it needs. And yeah, 6 years later, it's still going strong. So I'm just so thankful for my time in treatment.
Yeah. Well, I'm thankful for that as well. I'm really grateful for you and our friendship. So I'm glad that you're doing well. And there were parts of that story that I had never heard before. So thank you for sharing. That's very powerful and moving. And some of the things that that you were saying reminded me of stuff from growing up myself. And I've never had an eating disorder. I think before you've talked about how some people are more susceptible to having diets turn into eating disorders. And, you know, I remember in high school, I had a friend who she had put on her wall a quote that said, "Nothing tastes as good as skinny feels."
Yeah, that's Kate Moss. He said that.
Yeah, and I still think about that sometimes. Sometimes I think about that, you know, like when I'm eating ice cream and I'm like,
"No, this tastes amazing.
This tastes really good." But you do start. I start to feel a little bit of guilt. You know, like, do I need this? No. And I think, you know, that's what gets so interesting. Was it just somebody in your treatment, or was it one of the doctors who said food is medicine?
That was a gentleman who was also receiving treatment, actually. Okay. Yeah.
And I love that, because I have started to look at food as fuel.
Yeah.
You know, you can't expect your car to continue going on an empty tank. But it is so interesting when you start to think about, like, I see where it can be that slippery slope of what foods do our bodies need and what foods are good fuel versus, you know, can you still enjoy some food just because it tastes good and not feel guilty about that? And be healthy.
Yeah. The general message that I have heard from so many nutritionists is that all foods fit. We need to reject the notion that there are good foods and there are bad foods, that you can't enjoy your ice cream without having guilt. That is completely diet culture. And again, it's all around us. And when we have those messages and when we have those thoughts pop up, it's so important that we recognize them and get rid of them, shake it off and say, this is not a part of my life. And I'm choosing to be healthy in a way that works for me and my body. So,
yeah, I love that. And something I don't talk a lot about on here, but I'm going to go there a little bit, is pageantry. And that's actually how you and I met. And I'm just so curious, you know, the Miss America organization has now removed the swimsuit portion of the competition. But when you and I were competing, that was still a phase. And you did this after recovering from an eating disorder. I feel like that just would have taken a lot of mental strength. How was that for you?
You know, it's so interesting. I think I was kind of still on this high from being out of treatment. I was so strong. I had all these messages, like Brene Brown saying that, like, be vulnerable, be courageous. I just was really kind of riding that wave of recovery. And at the time, I actually talked with a mental health professional at the time to make sure that it was a good decision. It was a challenge that I was curious about because, of course, you get scholarship money when you compete. And so it was something that I wanted to do, and I had a team to help me stay well. So I didn't just hop in and then hop on my swimsuit or hop in my swimsuit and say, all right, you guys, this is it. But it was a process, and it was just really important for me to stay healthy throughout that too. I have one memory when we were at workshop one time, and there was it was one of our mentors that was telling us the best way to prepare for swimsuit. And I just remember her saying that pasta was crap and you should avoid it like the plague. And at the time I was so frustrated, because there are a lot of people who are susceptible to the development of an eating disorder. And I truly do believe that all foods fit, and that you can enjoy pasta, you can enjoy cookies, you can enjoy celery, you can enjoy anything, and that there is no moral value to food. So it was, I think, a difficult situation for a lot of people to be in. And I think it's really positive that there isn't a swimsuit competition now. Although for me, it was a powerful part of my recovery. I will say that.
Yeah. I kind of relate to that. I enjoyed the challenge and doing that for different reasons, I think, than you. But I think overall, it's really great that they have removed that phase of competition.
Yeah. Totally.
And I guess this might be a good segue then. Your platform while you were competing, now they call it a social impact initiative, was around eating disorders. And you've been doing work with that with the last 5-ish years.
Yeah.
You've been very involved with the National Eating Disorder Association. Is that the acronym is NEDA?
NEDA, that's right.
Okay. And I mean, you've been an ambassador, a spokesmodel. You even started and coordinated the annual Bend, Oregon NEDA charity walk. Mm-hmm. So a lot of work there. Why, in terms of bringing NEDA to Central Oregon, why did you decide to take on such a big task? Because I feel like that's a really big feat. and what work went into doing that, bringing NEDA to Central Oregon and organizing the charity walk?
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts. The first was that when I was looking into treatment, well, mostly when my mom was looking into treatment, she helped me out so much. Mm-hmm. She saw that there really weren't a lot of resources within Central Oregon. So had there been a treatment center, maybe I would have stayed. But the reality was that there wasn't in Central Oregon. So I ended up going back home to Minnesota to get treatment. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a big part of it, is when I went back to school, I was so passionate about eating disorder recovery and wellness. And I knew that I had to do something to help others, because I was a resident assistant at the dorms, and there's OSU Cascades was also there too, both COCC and OSU Cascades. And so a lot of people who are susceptible to the development of eating disorders are in early adolescence, or they're in their college years. And so for not having a treatment center and not having resources, it's potentially a little bit dangerous. So that was a big part of why I decided to start the walk. But, you know, it was just so needed, and it was so much fun. And NEDA walks are a celebration. They're about recovery. They're about bringing resources. They're about sharing stories. And so it's just been such an honor and a blessing to be able to work with this organization and to spread this message of recovery.
Yeah. And something that I think really shows the great work that you did and how successful it is that NEDA in Central Oregon is continuing. They're still doing these charity walks, even though you're not there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just think that's huge. I think things are successful when you can set things up in a way that can continue when you're gone. So how many, they have an upcoming charity walk, is that right?
Well, it's a little bit tricky, because this year with COVID-19, right. They've decided to split the U.S. into regions.
Oh.
So I believe it's like the Pacific Northwest or just the West Coast. Okay. And they're going to be online, actually. So if you have listeners all throughout the country or in different countries around the world, this is such a good time to get involved with NEDA. And to learn about eating disorders and to maybe be an ally or support someone who you know. So yeah, if you want to know more about NEDA, you can check out their website or go to their Instagram or Twitter. And they have so much good information about the walks too.
Yeah, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. And you're obviously not in Oregon anymore, not even in the United States. You've been able to travel over the last couple of years. You've lived in Dubai and you're now in Denmark. And you have some really exciting things coming up. You have recently been accepted into a master's program. I'm going to let you just share a bit about that because it makes me excited.
Definitely. So it's development and international relations with a focus on global refugee studies. It's at the University of Aalborg in Copenhagen. So right now I'm living in Roskilde, Denmark. And so it'll be about like a 30-minute train ride into the big city to go to school here. But it's a two-year program. It's heavy with research. I think we have to write about an 80-page research paper. And in Denmark, they do single spaces too. So it's a big project, but I'm really, really excited to start this next step with my education and to see where it goes from there.
Yeah, I am just so excited for you. I'm also a bit jealous because that's amazing. I think if I could get paid to go to school, I think I would just continue getting degrees.
Yeah.
But that was also quite the process for you though too.
yes.
But I'm so excited for you and what you have ahead. And you are also starting your own podcast. And this part here will kind of bring this episode full circle. Your podcast is about eating disorders, but also looking at it through a global lens. Can you give us a little teaser or, share a little bit more about what your podcast is going to be about? It's called Life with Color, or maybe something that you've learned through your time in Dubai or Denmark.
Yeah, I'm so excited. The podcast is going to be launching on July 1st. So it's a Wednesday, and it'll be at 6 o'clock Central European time. But basically, this podcast examines the intersection between eating disorders in different societies around the world. And it's about education and supporting people and families who have been affected by eating disorders. And in the podcast, I'll be interviewing nutritionists and psychologists and other eating disorder professionals. And I'll also be interviewing people who have experienced an eating disorder in recovery. And all over the world too. So it's not just limited to the US. So it's something that I've been working on that I'm so excited and I'm very much looking forward to sharing with the rest of the world.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm really excited for you. I know you've shared a bit in terms of your story and information through your blog. And I think that this will just kind of add so much to that as you get to interview and talk with other people from all over the world, which is really, really exciting.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. My blog is Catherine HN. You can find more about the podcast there. It's also going to be on YouTube, so it'll be in a film format. It'll be on all major podcast platforms as well as Instagram and Facebook. You can find the Life with Color podcast there too. So excited about that. Yeah.
And that releases in just like a week, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Why did you choose Life with Color? I'm curious, the title.
Yeah. So when you have an eating disorder, it is such a dark time in your life. And you also have a lot of black and white or all or nothing thinking, and it just limits your possibilities. And like what we were talking about earlier with food limitations too, when you get into recovery, it's the complete opposite. You have so many possibilities. You can eat anything that you want. You can have so many different opportunities in life, and you can live in them, and you can be in the moment and experience the full color spectrum of possibilities. So that's why I decided to name it the Life with Color, because it celebrates recovery from eating disorders.
I love that. And so really quickly, again, if people want to follow and listen, they can search Life with Color on any podcast platform.
Yep.
And you have an Instagram account, correct?
Yeah, Life with Color Podcast. I think I have 25 whole followers right now. So
slowly but surely growing in size. So it's good. It's exciting.
All right. So go give Life with Color podcast a follow. Sometimes it can be a slow beginning, but I think it's important to not let that discourage you, because everybody has to start somewhere.
Totally.
And then before we wrap things up officially, I ask everyone the same five questions. So the first one is, what is your favorite or must read book?
Yeah. So my favorite of all time is To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. But another one that I've been reading recently is So You Want to Talk About Race. And it's by Igema, I think it's pronounced, Alumo. I'm so, so sorry for butchering that name. It's a beautiful name. But yeah, again, that's So You Want to Talk About Race.
Awesome. That's on my, I have a lot of books about race. I just started White Fragility. And that one is on my list, but I have not started it yet.
Okay. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. This next one I think is so important. But what do you do for self-care?
Yeah. So eating disorder recovery is all about self-care. So basically it's about eating a variety of foods. For me, that's intuitive eating. It's movement that feels good. So whether that's walking or dancing or just doing something that feels good for my body at that moment. And also sleeping enough. If I get 8 to 9, maybe sometimes even 10 hours, I am so much happier than when I do not have that same level of sleep.
Yeah, sleep is, the older I'm getting, the more I realize how important sleep is.
Yes, 100%, 100%.
You've mentioned, I'm going to kind of go down a rabbit hole really fast. You mentioned intuitive eating a couple times, and I think that is maybe a term that some people don't know. What is intuitive eating?
Yeah, it's basically just listening to your body. And so if your body is craving salt, heck, maybe it's because you have a salt deficiency and maybe you need it. So it's all about listening to your body's cues and just going with them, not judging them, but just going with them, and listening to fullness, listening to hunger, and just really taking into account what your body needs, not what your mind needs, not what diet society or diet culture tells you that you need, but what your body actually needs.
Nice. Okay. And then you are obviously, you're traveling, you're living all over the world. What is your biggest travel necessity?
Yeah, so I have the three P's. The first P is a phone with Google Maps. I get lost basically everywhere I go, so a phone with Google Maps is very much needed. My second P is a plan. So I always do a lot of research going into any trip that I have planned. So yeah, planning is really important. And the last P is my partner. I have a lovely partner named Simon, and he is someone who I love to go and explore the world with. So those are my three P's.
I love that. I love that. Made me really happy. I need all three of those P's.
Yes.
Your first two reminded me of when I actually visited you in Dubai.
Oh my gosh.
I visited you before and after a trip. And the second time on my way back, I decided to rent a car.
Oh my gosh.
did not use my phone in the airport when I was connected to Wi-Fi. And I left the airport with the rental car at like 4 a.m. or some insanely early hour.
You were tired.
and obviously had only been to Dubai once, and Simon drove us around, so, you know, did not have to pay too much attention. And what was probably supposed to be like a 40-minute drive to your apartment took me a couple hours. I think I ended up getting to your apartment at like 8 a.m.
Oh my gosh. Well, I can relate to that. And the roads there are really crazy too. And they have highways that are like 7 lanes wide, and there's just no rules. So I can relate to that with the chaos of driving there.
It was a fun adventure, but I definitely should have had those first two P's. The third P would have helped too, but
yes.
Okay, we're almost done with these questions. When you were a little kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
it's kind of like, what didn't I want to be? I wanted to be a marine biologist, a geologist, a mermaid. I wanted to be an actor on Disney Channel. Basically, both Barbie and her wardrobe and my parents told me that I could do whatever I wanted. And so it changed basically daily.
I very much relate to that.
Yeah. Well, there's so much out there. There's so much out there.
There is. And then the last one that I think is kind of a feel-good question, and ties in well to the title of Contagious Courage. What gives you hope for the future?
Yeah, I love this question. But basically, it's people like you, Stephanie. It's people who stand up for social justice, people who know it's right, and to stand up for people who might not have a voice. And they spread messages focusing on love and resilience, inclusivity, and also, of course, courage. So it's definitely people like you who are out there hustling and doing right in the world.
Oh, well, thank you.
I was really totally.
But yeah, I mean, I agree. That was one of the main reasons that I wanted to do this, was just because I'd have conversations like this one that we're having. And I just wanted to bottle these conversations up because they were conversations that I'd walk away from feeling like my cup was full. I was energized. I was hopeful for the future and wanted to preserve these conversations and then share them with others. So thank you for talking with me today, and hopefully I'll get to see you at some point in the not too distant future if we can do international travel again.
Oh, I so hope so. And it's been such an honor to be on this show. And I've been listening to it over the quarantine months too, and have just loved following this journey of yours too. So thank you so much for having me on. And yes, I would love to connect sometime in the future. Wherever the country, you know, wherever the location, I'm there. Of course, if it's safe. Yeah.
All right. Well, perfect. Thank you so much, Katie.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider rating the Contagious Courage podcast, leaving a review, or taking a screenshot to share on your own social media. It all means so much to a newbie podcast like mine. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next week.